Major funding for Backstory is provided by an anonymous donor, the University of Virginia, the National Endowment for the Humanities, and the Joseph and Robert Cornell Memorial Foundation.
From the Virginia Foundation for the Humanities, this is Backstory with the American History Guys.
Welcome to the show. I'm Brian Ballow, and I'm here with Peter Onuf.
Hey there, Brian.
Ed Ayers is with us.
Hello, Brian.
And we're going to kick it off today in 1956 at a party in New York City. The hosts of this party were a couple named the Saltzmans. They were Greenwich Village bohemian types. And on the night of this party, Sue Saltzman was steamed. Earlier that day, she had lost out on an incredible bargain at the local Salvation Army. It was an authentic 1920s full-length raccoon fur men's coat.
She recounted a near grappling match between herself and another Salvation Army patron over this coat, which was a relic of the furry fad from the 1920s.
This is Jennifer Lizott, a historian at Colby College. She says that in the roaring 20s, these raccoon coats had been all the rage on Ivy League campuses. But when the stock market crashed, affluence went out of style, and so did the coats. By the 1950s, they were a relic of a bygone era.
One of the guests at the Saltzman party, it turned out, had a relative with a warehouse full of pre-war men's clothing. After hearing about the Salvation Army drama, the guest offered Sue a crack at any raccoon coats that might be in the warehouse. But it quickly became clear that everybody at the party also wanted a coat. So the Saltzmans decided to go into business.
In the following days, they called around to secondhand stores and warehouses and bought up all the raccoon coats they could find, which they promptly turned around and sold to their artsy downtown friends.
It wasn't very long until Glamour magazine actually published a photo of a coonskin coat and named the Saltzmans as major suppliers.
Letters and phone calls started pouring in, including one from Lord and Taylor. Before long, the very same moth-eaten coats that had spent 25 years packed away in boxes were hanging on the racks of New York's poshest department stores.
These department stores were promising, you know, shabbily genteel coats full of lovely holes and a snobby seediness. The Saltzmans fueled fur's romantic images by often reporting that, for example, in one coat, we found a revolver and a mask, and in another, a list of speakeasies.
This, of course, was hardly the first fashion revival in American history, but the raccoon coat craze of 1956 and 1957 was something new. It was a craze not simply for the old style, but for the actual coats themselves, which explains why the craze only lasted 2 years.
They ran out of coats.
But short-lived as the fashion may have been, Jennifer Lizott says that it had a huge impact on secondhand clothing culture.
It really wasn't until this raccoon coat craze that vintage clothing became something that was desirable, not just old, not just secondhand, not just used.
The raccoon coat craze was the first time clothes were marketed as vintage. It was the beginning, says Lizott, of what has become a very familiar phenomenon, wealthy people paying more for an item because of its aura of authenticity.
You know, recently I've actually seen a 1970s mesh back trucker hat, which, you know, emblem of blue-collar work that was being sold for nearly $50.
Now, it's true that there's a tradition of wearing secondhand clothes as an anti-consumerist statement, a tradition that goes back to the 1960s. But Lizott says that the raccoon coat story reveals a still older tradition of spending top dollar to appear countercultural.
It simply doesn't avoid the system. It's anti-consumerist consumerism.
Whether or not we are particularly fashionable, the clothes we wear necessarily say things to the people around us. Sometimes those clothes say, hey, we want to fit in, we want to belong. Sometimes they say, no, we reject the status quo. Either way, we wear layers of meaning, many of which come to us from the past.
Which makes the topic of fashion prime for the picking by us history guys. And so today on the show, Ed, Peter, and I are walking the runway of fashion's history here in the United States. We've got the story of a group of anthropologists who tried to put their stamp on America's early 20th century look, of spinster sisters who succeeded where those anthropologists failed, and of the sartorial lightning rod known as the Zoot Suit.
But first, we're going to spend a few minutes in the colonial era. For well over 100 years, American colonists imported their textiles and their styles from Mother England. But by the 1760s, talk of independence was in the air, and suddenly it mattered a lot where your clothes were made. If Americans could produce their own fabric at home, so the thinking went, then they could become that much less reliant on European imports.
This new, highly politicized style of wearing made-in-America clothing became known as homespun. It was a simple, unadorned look, in keeping with what many at the time considered to be the small R Republican principles. Homespun textiles would prove that clothes could be equalizers rather than marks of status and wealth. Who was supposed to actually make this homemade fabric? Well, that would be the job of women. Consider this quote from a Massachusetts newspaper in 1769.
It was early conceived by the most sagacious and knowing nations that a number of females had always determined the condition of men by means of their spinning wheels. I presume there never was a time when the spinning wheel could more influence the affairs of men than at present.
I don't want to say that it's entirely a myth, a total fabrication, but it wasn't as broad or deep as we have thought.
This is Kate Hallman, a historian at American University. She points out that while the image of women at their spinning wheels was a potent symbol for advocates of independence, most of those advocates were men. And so this whole homespun thing may have been more rhetoric than reality.
Certainly some women would come together in a very social fashion and have spinning bees. But, you know, if you go back to some of the earlier women's history of the 70s and 80s, what you see in the evidence there is that women really couldn't stand spinning. You know, it's not how they would choose to spend their time. So it was limited, and it maybe didn't have the kind of breadth and depth that we have wanted to imagine for this period. We like to think of our founding era as kind of pure and marked by sacrifice and coming together. And the reality is much more complicated than that. People had their own positions and things that they wanted to express and, you know, were apt to feel somewhat perhaps coerced.
Yeah. So this homespun thing was really a pseudo-democratic look at it was imposed for ideological reasons on the people. It wasn't as if it sprang naturally out of the style sense of the people or anything like that.
No. In fact, I mean, my findings are that it's a very top-down vision, very enforced by a certain set of, not necessarily elite men, some elite, some middling men, but the leaders of the resistance movement generate the homespun revolution.
Well, do you have evidence that patriotic women who otherwise sympathized with the revolutionary cause resisted this particular form of patriotism, that the idea that they should produce this cloth and then wear it?
Well, I don't have a lot of smoking gun evidence of that. You know, I don't have a lot of women saying, God, I really just, who needs homespun? I don't want to wear that. But what you do see is the persistence of certain styles, of imported styles and imported cloth, sometimes even in the face of non-consumption. Broad skirts, the hoops get really wide, and that's very much about taking up space and drawing attention and displaying fabrics. And then heads get very high, so you get a very high, elaborately produced hairstyle made of actual real hair and wigs and often festooned with pearls or flowers. And so women in the 1770s, so this is right on the eve of the War for Independence, and you see it in Philadelphia, you see it in places like Boston and Charleston, women's fashions get very big. So that if you look at practices next to proclamations, if you will, you do see what is unspoken about adherence or lack thereof to the homespun movement.
But, Kate, you've suggested that the homespun look was patriotic, that it would mark a commitment to the Republican Revolution. It was a Republican aesthetic. We don't care about luxury and all that kind of stuff. But when you take a longer look at the history of fashion, do you think a Republican fashion aesthetic ever really took hold?
I would say that it did. That by the 1790s or maybe the first decade of the 19th century, you have some reconciliation, if you will, or stylistically, between a look of republicanism, small r, and the demands of high style. And that arrives, it's a kind of French Revolutionary era style, the high-waisted Grecian gown, white or light-colored fabrics, imported usually, right, still. But that look of the Greek statuary, right, is at that point by the 1790s or the first decade of the 19th century, both high style and comes under attack as such. But it also is, it's a look of republicanism.
Yeah. So that was the empire look, as it was known, diving bodices and all that.
Right.
And here you can combine republicanism with high style. Who would have ever thought that was possible?
Well, interestingly enough, most men don't find that that's very possible. That I think, you know, women can embrace it as both, and it seems to solve this problem. But because it is still a high fashion and it is an imported style, this time French, with all sorts of those associations. And when then you layer onto that all of this critique about the style being too diaphanous, revealing of the body, transparent, you know, bespeaking libertinism, then it's really a problem.
So, Kate, you're suggesting that fashion has broad ideological and political associations. It's contested. Mm. People are concerned about fashion,
yes,
and particularly the way women dress themselves.
Mm-hmm. Yes. I think that throughout this period, women and women's bodies become this a litmus test and a site for projecting a certain vision of the nation, of legitimacy. And that can run a couple of different ways. On the one hand, the women need to be displaying, you know, a la homespun or something like it, Republican virtue. On the other hand, for a long time in the British Empire, women, not just women, men too, but women have been the symbols of and the arbiters of refinement and gentility and cosmopolitanism. And you know, this is a moment of some uncertainty. This is a brand new experiment, a new nation. Yes, Republican, small r, but also a nation. And how does a nation need to look? And so therein lies the tension, the conflict.
So were a lot of women seeing therapists at this time because of this cognitive dissonance?
Oh, sadly. But men should have been, certainly.
Kate Holman is a history professor at American University. Her book is called The Politics of Fashion in 18th Century America.
It's time for a short break, but don't go away. When we get back, a group of anthropologists try to make their mark on the New York fashion scene.
You're listening to Backstory. We'll be right back.
We're back with Backstory, the show that looks to the past to understand the America of today. I'm Peter Onuf.
I'm Brian Bello.
And I'm Ed Ayers. Today in the show, we're exploring the role of fashion in American history.
As we do with each of our shows, we've been inviting your feedback on today's topic on our website. A listener named Cash left us a note, and we decided to give him a call. Cash, welcome to the show.
Thanks. It's great to get to talk to you guys today.
Yeah. What do you have for us?
Well, I was having a discussion with some folks the other day at work about fashion, and we had talked about Ben Franklin's fur hats that he wore while he was serving as an envoy to France,
yeah,
during the American Revolution.
Mm-hmm.
He was painted with them, and the French just really came to associate Franklin with these fur hats as a symbol of America.
Mm-hmm.
Were there any earlier examples of American fashion being exported back to Europe instead of us just importing everything?
No. In fact, I'd question that was an American fashion, because who made it fashionable? It was the French, who got all excited about this Quaker, supposed Quaker. Of course, he was a phony Quaker wearing this funny hat. He found it was fashionable, and then he had a lot of them made, and that was his look.
Peter, that's so cynical, man. So let me ask this. Why would this fake Quaker show up in Paris with a beaver on his head if he did not think that there was some purpose behind it?
Well, he was Mr. Natural. And nature used to be a bad thing. That is, nature is associated with the wilderness, which is a terrible howling place, barbarism, savages. But there was a cult of the natural in the Enlightenment, and that people like Franklin could exploit it. And that is getting close to nature, being authentic, understanding nature's laws, and being at one with nature. That was a cool thing, and that's what Franklin knew he was exploiting. That is, the only comparative advantage you could have coming from nowhere in the New World was that you were closer to nature.
Hey, Peter, I have a question.
Yeah.
It seems to me that fashion is also about difference, right? I mean, if we all dress the same, I can't imagine calling that fashionable.
It would be one giant college.
Exactly. Yeah. Wasn't Franklin really a difference maker showing up there in Paris? And might that not be the basis for a new fashion trend?
Oh, yeah. I think that's a good point, Brian. That is his very presence in Paris showed that the world was changing in a fundamental way. Remember, the French had recently lost much of North America to the British in the Seven Years' War. And here, all of a sudden, it looks like the British Empire is going to fall apart. So the monstrous empire that overthrew the French in North America was now on its back heels. And these backwoods people were showing them a good fight in the revolution. So I think he brought a lot of cred with him to Paris. And I think that's right. There's an aura about him because he is American. He didn't have to do anything.
Right. Just different. Yeah,
just be different.
Yes. And also it was really part of Franklin's political savvy that when he goes to France, he adopts this character. He creates this persona of the wildness of America when the whole life of he and his contemporaries in the colonies had been to try to tame the wilderness, to try to bring their style of civilization to the New World.
So speaking of wearing animals on top of our heads, Ed, I want to know when people started wearing raccoons on top of their heads.
Well, the American Indians had done it for a long time, and this is kind of a parallel to the story that Peter was telling, in the same way that the ultra-fashionable French people were taken with wearing at least pretend beavers on their heads. The women styled their hair so that it had the same kind of shape. Mm-hmm. So did the American frontiersmen, the white guys, Davy Crockett, Daniel Boone, adapt from the Indians the idea of using the entire animal skin, complete with the tail, taking Franklin one step further, I think, of the raccoon. And so much in the same way that Franklin showing up in Paris in the 18th century, these guys, who one of them ends up being a congressman, shows up in Washington with a raccoon on his head, and it becomes distinguishing for him for the same reason.
So could we tease out a theme here? Because honestly, when I think about the 20th century, I think about blue jeans, which come out of the West. I think about cowboy boots. These are all things that America exported to the world. So is that what America has to add to fashion for at least, you know, 200 or 300 years, or kind of frontier stylings?
Yeah, I think that's right, Brian. It's think of the ways in which American vernacular music, jazz, blues, what we now call folk, all this stuff represents the opposite of high culture.
Well, that's right. And if you think about the other fashions we've exported, even when after blue jeans and black leather jackets, it became sportswear, right? I remember when I first went to Europe and people were friendly to me and said, Ed, we can always tell Americans because they're wearing athletic shoes all the time. So America really has nothing other than informality to sell.
Hey, thanks for calling, Cash.
Absolutely. It was great getting to talk with you guys.
Thanks very much, Cash.
Bye-bye.
Bye.
Ben Franklin may have succeeded in influencing French trends in hatwear, but as late as the 20th century, Americans continued looking to Europe, and especially France, for their fashion guidance. When war broke out across the continent in 1914, the European clothing industry switched gears and devoted itself instead to serving military needs. And this created a bit of a crisis among fashion-minded Americans.
Periodicals in New York especially were kind of decrying the situation, saying that there's no real American design and there's no direction coming from Europe now.
This is Anne Marguerite Tartsinis, a curator at the Bard Graduate Center in New York City. She says that where some saw crisis, others in New York's art and museum circles saw an opportunity. Like Arthur Wesley Dow, an influential professor of art education at Columbia University.
It is time we throw off these shackles and endeavor to express ourselves in our own way. Our design should be distinctly American. We ought to create a new period style for our own needs. We Americans can make an art use with the naivetes of the mountain builders, cliff dwellers, Pueblo tribes, Alaskans, Mayans, and Peruvians.
So he's conflating all these different communities. He's lumping all of this indigenous material together and seeing it as a way to really throttle American design into the forefront.
If you're in New York City and you want to infuse some pre-Columbian flavor into the local fashion scene, where do you go for inspiration? Well, how about the American Museum of Natural History? A small group of anthropologists there were convinced that they held the key to unlocking the future of American design.
Curators felt that objects in the collections could be seen as examples to inspire and educate designers to create something new and to create something that was wholly separate from Europe.
In 1915, these curators opened up their specimen storage rooms, and they invited influential New York designers behind the scenes to see what real American design was all about.
They were even letting fashion designers pin, you know, hide jackets and Siberian coats to dress forms so they could model their contemporary designs after these more historical and indigenous designs. They also started a very ambitious design contest series, which started in 1916 and ran until 1922. And the mission of these contests was to get these designs being made by the designers who were interested and ambitious enough to use the collections at the museum as inspiration for their own work, to get those designs out into manufacture.
And believe it or not, some of these designs made their way to market. In 1917, the John Wanamaker department store unveiled a showroom called Modern Maya Made. It contained dresses, coats, and hats that integrated native textiles into contemporary fashion design. Now, looking to the past for inspiration was not a new idea in fashion design. In fact, European designers had also drawn on various folk customs. But back in Europe, this chain of influence was a little less complicated. The designers, or at least the people buying their clothes, could in many cases claim a direct family line to the people whose styles they were appropriating. A group of white guys in New York, on the other hand, how could they possibly lay claim to native cultures stretching from Alaska to the Amazon?
The curators saw the indigenous communities that they were appropriating as inherently American, arguing that it was in the soil, that it was about the land they were inhabiting. And even though Euro-American culture could lay no claim to the cultures of the indigenous Americas, they made this conceptual leap by thinking about the territory as American.
100 years later, this kind of thinking may seem naive at best. But remember, at the time, ideas about eugenics and the inferiority of non-white races were very widespread. In this context, these anthropologists believed they were taking a powerfully progressive stand.
In the end, the modern Maya Made look didn't exactly catch on. Nor, for that matter, did any of the other mashups of native cultures that the anthropologists were trying to promote. But there's a coda to this story. In the 1970s, American fashion designers again turned to the now controversial practice of indigenous appropriation. But this time, says Tarsinis, American consumers were buying.
there's an explosion of design that looks to particularly the indigenous American material, and you see it in fringed garments and hide jackets. You know, even it's this vision of an iconic American Indian with the headdress as being this kind of definitive American vision. And, you know, you see designers like Giorgio Santangelo and Ralph Lauren kind of looking to the American West as a source for design. And you see it again even recently. In recent years, Donna Karan even had, her runway was filled with fringed garments, right? So it's this kind of Western ideal of, you know, of the American landscape and the people who inhabit it. And that finds its way into the clothing, and it finds and then eventually is distilled into kind of everyday dress.
That's Anne Marguerite Tartsinas. Her book and exhibition about the fashions inspired by museum artifacts is called An American Style: Global Sources for New York Textile and Fashion Design, 1915 to 1928. You can look at some photos from her exhibit at backstoryradio.org.
One fashion that you may have noticed has been on the rebound lately is the beard. Earlier this year, the New York Times remarked on the trend with an article slugged, "The Brooklyn Beard Goes Mainstream."
Now, when, you may be wondering, did the beard trend first hit the American mainstream? Well, we're going to take the story back to the late 1830s. Now, by this point, members of the more refined urban professional classes had been wearing facial hair for a few years. They called that look whiskers, by which they could mean a carefully trimmed beard, lengthy sideburns, or even wax mustaches.
What they would have called a beard was different. Beards were wild, unkempt, and often came down to the chest. And in the late 1830s, they became the subject of newspaper controversy, for and against. Historian Sean Trainer has collected some of these debates. Those against, he says, argued that beards were indecent and uncultured, but proponents insisted that they saved time and money, or that they were biblical and therefore virtuous, or even that they had health benefits.
There are folks who claim that the beard is sort of a natural respirator, that you can avoid throat infections if you wear a beard, that the beards and mustaches will filter out the particulate matter in the air, and perhaps, you know, men with beards will be less likely to be afflicted with tuberculosis.
But Trainer says that in the 1830s, there was yet another more important connotation of beards.
The habit of wearing a beard is a manly and noble one. Its abandonment has commonly been accompanied not only by a period of general effeminacy, but even by the decline and fall of the states.
There's a sense that wearing a beard is not merely reflective of a sort of strength and virility, but is perhaps even productive of it, that by growing a beard that you will be stronger, you will be more robust, more virile, that you can go out and do these manly things that perhaps they've always wanted to do but couldn't do because they didn't have facial hair.
Considering all this, you might expect the beard to be found on the American frontier, but Trainer says that it was just the opposite. This is a period when Americans were flocking to cities for jobs behind desks as clerks or salesmen. And it was these guys who wore and argued for the biggest beards.
Many of these folks are actually coming from the same sort of professional urban circles as the clerks, you know, sort of who are wearing whiskers. But it is an idea that they're aspiring to and that they think the beard is suggestive of. But the thing that's actually really interesting is that you do find a handful of critics, especially among Western men, and really, really kind of object to this idea of the beard as a style of the frontier, a style of sort of rugged masculinity.
It's very interesting. You certainly don't think of cowboys as having beards, do you?
Right, you don't. In fact, an interesting example is there's a famous mural in the Capitol Rotunda entitled "Westward, the Course of Empire Takes Its Way." It features some rather rugged-looking Western men with facial hair. But at least one commentator objected to this particular way of depicting Western men and said that, you know, while Western men, to sort of use a modern term, might get scruffy every once in a while, you know, they outdoing their sort of frontiersy business,
right?
That whenever they got a chance, they found some warm water, they found some soap, and they found a razor, and they shaved themselves. So, I mean, there is this sense, at least coming from a few sources, that the idea of beard wearing as kind of a Western affectation, that's just incorrect.
So what is it that American men in the 1840s would be reacting against? Why are they so eager to prove themselves manly?
Well, the beard, I think, is the beard and facial hair more broadly, the response to a number of factors. And, you know, the first perhaps is the burgeoning of women's activism, women's rights movement, and the fear among some men that their prerogative is being challenged and that the beard becomes a way to sort of reinforce a distinction between men and women that they feel is being lost.
Even the ladies who in years past so lovingly admired these noble badges of men's dignity now demand their curtailment, if not utter extermination. They wish to make a clean shave of all badges of manly superiority. They seem determined to have an equality between the sexes anyhow. If they can't elevate themselves up, they are determined to elevate the men down.
But also, this is, you know, this is the great period of manifest destiny. You know, you see these folks talking about the bearded races are the conquering races.
In the world's history, the bearded races have at all times been the most important actors. And there is no part of the body which, on the whole, they have shown more readiness to honor.
It cannot be denied that a certain superiority has always been conveyed by the presence of the beard.
If you want to make your presence felt throughout the world as a person of sort of imperial power, that the beard is an emblem for that.
Now, I know that in the 1850s, there was a kind of palpable excitement in the air about the impending war. And do you think it's possible that some American men sort of donned beards as a way to show themselves as men worthy of this moment?
Yeah, I think that as the sectional crisis deepens, as the likelihood of some sort of conflict, whether it's violent or whether it's political, deepens, that I think that the beard is part of a way that men kind of prepare themselves mentally or socially or culturally, that this is the way that men thought that they should or needed to look when facing a crisis or when facing something that they thought would test their masculinity.
So as you pointed out, men imagine wearing a beard the years before the Civil War as a kind of preparation for the crisis. But as you know, they still wear beards for decades after the Civil War. Does the beard then have a different meaning?
Well, I think that wearing the beard was part of sort of marking one's status as a veteran. And I mean veteran kind of expansively here, not just as a veteran of the Union or Confederate Army, but as a veteran of the experience of the war. And I do think that it continues to carry that meaning throughout the end of the century, and that perhaps one of the reasons why the style sort of falls into disrepair, as it were, is that, you know, people are beginning to try to put the war behind them. And I think that, you know, the beard is part of that, or rather getting rid of the beard. I mean, moving beyond a style of men's grooming in which beard wearing and facial hair is kind of the dominant mode of comportment.
Sean Traynor teaches history and women's studies at Penn State University. If you go to our website, you can read a link to an article he wrote for The Atlantic about the complicated racial history of facial hair. I like
beards, yes! It's time for another short break. When we get back, the story of the only fashion trend with a riot named after it.
You're listening to Backstory. We'll be back in a minute. This is Backstory. I'm Peter Onuf.
I'm Brian Bellow.
And I'm Ed Ayers. Today in the show, the statements that Americans have made with their fashions over the years. We're going to spend a few minutes now with a fashion trend whose meaning underwent a remarkable number of transformations over a relatively short period of time. And that would be the zoot suit.
I want a zoot suit with the replete, with the drape, shape, and the stuff cup.
This was a look invented in the late 1930s by young African-American men in Harlem, and it was a lot like a regular men's suit, only more so. More in the sleeves, which reached down to the fingertips. More in the pants, which ballooned. More vibrant, red, blue, bright green, and mustard yellow fabrics.
I think that it is a playing with the fashions that are already there for men, but just bringing it to a higher level.
Kathy Peiss is a historian at the University of Pennsylvania, and she's traced the changing meaning of the zoot suit. The first jump she's found was from Harlem to Los Angeles, where the style was adopted by Mexican Americans. And there, in June of 1943, it took center stage in a violent episode involving American military men, an episode that came to be known as the Zoot Suit Riots.
Servicemen pick out zoot-suited Mexican-American youth as targets, and they, when they're on leave, they go into the city, and they go into movie houses, restaurants, dance halls, and all over the streets, looking for men wearing zoot suits and beating them up and tearing the suits off their backs.
So calling it a zoot suit riot is kind of a misnomer in a way. It's not that the zoot suiters were actually starting any kind of conflict, right?
That's correct. I mean, it should have been called the servicemen's riot. And by calling it the zoot suit riot, it was a way to reduce the racial identification of this conflict. You know, so they're going after these young men in these outlandish outfits who are not responsible people.
If you're wondering why the outlandishness of an outfit would be associated with irresponsibility, consider the context. This was 1943, after all, smack in the middle of World War II.
With the arrival of World War II, with the need to conserve fabric, these suits become targets of concern, both on the part of the government and on the part of ordinary citizens who see them as unpatriotic.
And they're unpatriotic because they're consuming material that could otherwise be used for uniforms and other war material, right?
Yes, they're seen as unpatriotic because they use so much material. But also they become associated with racial and ethnic minorities. And there's so much racial tension in this era that the suit also is unfairly seen as a sign of a draft dodger or someone who's shirking his patriotic duty.
Peiss puts most of the blame for the zoot suit's increasingly negative connotations at the feet of newspapers in L.A. In the early 1940s, competition among those papers was fierce, and they tried to outdo each other with breathless accounts of local crime.
They really target Mexican-American youth as criminal, as juvenile delinquent, and the federal government asks them not to identify these young people as Mexican-American because it is offending our allies, the Mexicans, and the good neighbor policy. And so they begin to use this term zoot suiter to describe Mexican-Americans. And there's a series of violent incidents that brings the zoot suit into public light in a very glaring and negative way. And that contributes to this idea that it is the zoot suit that is the cause of the riot, that somehow this item of fashion can be a sinister force in and of itself.
In subsequent years, the zoot suit would become the preferred look for the bad guys in Disney cartoons. But at the same time, Pye says the zoot suit was taking on an entirely different meaning overseas. American jazz musicians and movies had carried the look to countries like France and Germany, even the Soviet Union. Black South Africans, even in the midst of apartheid, started donning it. And in these places, the zoot suit came to stand in for ideals of freedom and youthful independence.
Elements of it are used by young people in part to convey a certain kind of Americanness, which is interesting because in the United States, it's seen as being perhaps not American. So in France, for example, and even in Nazi Germany, there were young people who wore some zooted styling. In the case of the swing youth in Germany, as a way to kind of push back against Nazi regimentation.
The suits had a second act in America, too. In the 1960s, zoot suits began appearing as the outfit not of criminals, but rather of heroes in magazines, plays, and novels coming out of the Chicano Pride movement.
There is a search for usable myths, usable heroic figures, and some of that goes back to, you know, ancient Aztec mythological figures. But there's also a recovery of the zoot suit as actually a sign of assertion, of Mexican-American pride, a kind of redefining what it means for a new age.
And yet, despite all this, despite the highly politicized meanings of the Zoot Suit, Kathy Pye says we shouldn't reduce its story only to politics. Over the years, she says, people have had all kinds of reasons for wearing the outfit.
I guess what I would like people to think about is the way that fashion works in complicated ways and that its meanings are not easily reduced to politics. So there are moments when the Zoot Suit is intensely political, but there also are moments when it really is about pleasure, it's about aesthetics, and it's about an identity that's not simply a political identity.
That's Kathy Pice. She's a professor of history at the University of Pennsylvania and author of Zoot Suit, The Enigmatic Career of an Extreme Style. Zoot. We're going to dial the clock back now a few decades to earlier in the 20th century, to 1918, when a dress design and sewing prodigy named Mary Brooks Pickin was approached by a female physician.
Who came to her and said, I do not understand clothes, I never will, but I know I have a problem.
This is historian Linda Prevashevsky. She says that the physician that approached Mary Brooks Pickin had a professional wardrobe issue. Her peers and clients didn't take her seriously because of what she wore. And so she asked Mary,
would you look over my wardrobe and give me a diagnosis and prescribe me a new wardrobe? And Pickin did that, and the doctor reported that people who had never bothered to consult with her now did, that the other doctors she worked with treated her with more respect, and so did the nurses who worked with her, and she was cured. So that's where I get the idea, the term the dress doctors.
The women Linda refers to as the dress doctors taught home economics, retail, and art at land-grant universities in the early decades of the 20th century. And central to their teaching about wardrobe were rules about harmony that governed what shapes and textures and colors a woman could wear. There were also rules about rhythm, balance, proportion, and emphasis. Big hats, for example, were good because they emphasized the face, and that encouraged people to pay attention to what women had to say. Loud patterns, on the other hand, were a problem because they could be distracting and what they called unbalanced. And the dress doctors waged a decades-long war against high heels because shoes that constricted feet made a fluid, natural walking rhythm nearly impossible. A lot of these rules originated with a pair of sisters who taught at the University of Minnesota, Harriet and Veta Goldstein. I sat down with Prevashevsky to talk about the principles embedded in the Goldstein sisters' enormously influential textbook, Art in Everyday Life.
The idea was that art is something spiritual, it's something uplifting, it's an expression of God's creation, and it shouldn't just be for rich people.
Right.
It should be for everyone. And one of the ways you can bring it into your life is through how you decorate your home, how you lay out your garden, and what you wear.
How would they embody the lessons they were trying to convey?
Well, there are descriptions of what they wore. One of them always wore navy. The other one always wore maroon. They wore sensible Oxford shoes. Usually they had a little pin at the throat. And they wore big black hats that were too big for them. So I don't think you would have thought of them as fashion plates at all. But obviously each had chose navy or maroon because they thought that one played the best off their complexions.
So I have to admit that sounds as if, you know, the navy and maroon and the big black hats might not have been that inspiring. But it's my understanding that the Goldstein sisters were actually influential even beyond the University of Minnesota.
Oh, yes. First edition of their book, Art in Everyday Life, came out in 1925. It would have four more editions. And you can see their ideas in every single dress textbook written after their book comes out.
Wow.
And they managed to spread their story and their principles literally to millions of girls and women because these lessons were taught in home economics courses for girls at junior high school. And by the 1930s, 90% of girls in junior high school were required to take home economics courses. So it's literally generations of girls who are being taught these principles over time, which is why you can see them in action in most of the dress design you see in the early 20th century.
Were they arguing against any prevailing styles? Were they trying to reform what people were turning to as fashion?
I think the dressed actors were always acting as a kind of counterweight against fads, which stands for a day.
Oh, really?
Yeah, yeah. If you follow these principles, they argued, you will possess something beautiful that you will want to wear not just for a day, but for a long time until you just wear it out.
So I'm hearing kind of mixed signals here. On one hand, they sound very instrumental, very utilitarian. On the other hand, they're celebrating these values of art. How would they have reconciled those?
Well, if you think of them as drawing upon the arts and crafts movement, mm-hmm, mm-hmm. those two things are not at odds. Those two things were actually, within the arts and crafts movement, completely integrated.
Right.
Something cannot be beautiful if it's not useful.
Form and function.
Right. Form and function. They have to work together. They have to support one another. So I like to say, if a vase has a hole in the bottom, you can't really put flowers in it because you can't put water in it, right?
Right.
Well, shoes that keep a woman from walking naturally and gracefully with strength, those are bad shoes. They may be as decorated as you like. They may have a fabulously interesting look to them. But if she can't walk in them, they were by definition not beautiful.
You know, and as I look at the illustrations in your book and as I think about the movies I've seen from the 30s and the 40s and 50s, it seems that there is a kind of style that adheres to the principles of these women, that they do really care about sort of form and harmony and proportion and all this. And then, having lived through it, I happen to know that this kind of unravels in the 1960s. How would you explain that and what do we make of that?
Well, it does unravel, and for a couple of reasons, and you can see the logic of it. If in the 1960s we have several social movements that are questioning some really fundamental ways in which American society was organized, you know, the civil rights movement and then the women's movement, right? There used to be a lot of rules about how blacks should behave, how women should behave.
Right.
So a lot of rules then got questioned, including rules about dress, and were really seen as oppressive. Now, I don't think all of them were, but there was this period in the early 70s, it's really clear when feminist groups, women's liberation groups were approached and sort of asked, you know, can we interview you about fashion? And there would have been a lot to say, right? Getting rid of the girdle, the miniskirt being so undignified, the choice of pants for women, which used to be only for informal or sportswear and then became, you know, part of mainstream fashion. And they didn't even want to talk about
it. Right.
But actually, they would have had a lot of ideas and a lot of things to think and talk about. And I think, unfortunately, we got this sort of message that it doesn't matter or it shouldn't matter, but obviously it does. I mean, we're not blind. We see what people look like. We get impressions from what they're wearing, and it can have an effect on your life, on your career. So is there a smart way to think about it? And I do think the dress doctors laid out a lot of important information that is still useful.
Linda Prevashevsky is a professor of history at Notre Dame. You can read more about the Goldstein sisters in her new book, The Lost Art of Dress. His clothes are loud, but never square. It will make or break him, so he's got to buy the best, because he's a dedicated follower of fashion. That's going to do it for today. But we're eager to hear your thoughts. Let us know at backstoryradio.org. We've got more information on all of today's guests there, as well as a special web exclusive about the zipper's long, and I do mean long, journey onto American flies. And while you're there, take a moment to weigh in on our upcoming show topics. Whatever you do, don't be a stranger.
Today's episode of Backstory was produced by Tony Field, Nina Ernest, Andrew Parsons, Kelly Jones, Emily Gaddick, Jamal Milner, and Bruce Wallace, and by Emily Charnock, who we are very sorry to say goodbye to this week. For the past year and a half, Emily has not only been in charge of interacting with our listeners, but she's also pitched and produced some of our very best stories.
We're not just losing a talented radio colleague.
We're also saying goodbye to a very talented scholar. Emily completed a terrific dissertation on American political history recently, and we're thrilled that she has accepted a position at the University of Cambridge in her native England.
Hey, Emily, we're going to miss you, and thanks for everything. And special thanks this week also to Mary Capel and Robert Friedel. Our voice actors were Matthew Gibson, Peter Headland, James Scales, Rob Vaughn, Brendan Wolfe, and our intern, Sam Almschneider. Backstory's executive producer is Andrew Windham. Major support for Backstory is provided by an anonymous donor, the University of Virginia, the National Endowment for the Humanities, and the Joseph and Robert Cornell Memorial Foundation. Additional funding is provided by Weinstein Properties, by the Tomato Fund, cultivating fresh ideas in the arts, the humanities, and the environment, and by History Channel, history made every day.
Brian Ballow is professor of history at the University of Virginia. Peter Onuf is professor of history emeritus at UVA and senior research fellow at Monticello. Ed Ayers is president and professor of history at the University of Richmond. Backstory was created by Andrew Windham for the Virginia Foundation for the Humanities.